Genesis 17, this will be part four and the last of studies that we've had on the Abrahamic covenant. So again, Genesis 17 is where we'll be tonight. We'll look at two passages in Genesis 17 as we look to finish up. So Abraham, if you're taking notes, the Abrahamic covenant, this is part four. Before I give you the outline, next week, if you want to read ahead, we'll be looking at, actually what we'll do is the next 2 weeks. Next week, we'll do Psalm 3, and the week after that, do Psalm 4. They're somewhat related. One is a morning psalm, and one is the evening psalm, and we're going to look at Psalm 3, and then we'll look at Psalm 4, and then we'll start a new series after that. So Psalm 3, and then Psalm 4 over the next two weeks. Studies. So as far as tonight, what we're going to do, I will do a brief review of the handout, and what we'll look at is the introduction, what we covered, which is the summary of just essentially where we are at when the covenant is given, and then we'll look at, and then I'm going to review basically some of the content, the Abrahamic covenant. Then we'll look at the contents, and tonight we're going to be looking at Genesis 17, 1 through 8. The contents of the covenant reiterated there. So let me make sure we're clear. So basically, I'm going to do a brief review of the handout, what we've covered so far. So that's Roman numeral 1, 2, and then the contents of the covenant, which is in Genesis 12, 13, 15. So that'll be a review. But for tonight, we'll look at Genesis 17, 1 through 8. That is the reiteration or reconfirmation of the covenant. And then lastly, we'll look at Genesis 17, 9 through 14, where all the men squeamishly say circumcision. Okay. That makes sense. So since we didn't meet last time, just take a look briefly at your handout, and I'm just going to review this. I won't go over it in too much detail at this point. So in the introduction, if you look at the handout, Roman numeral 1, there's A and B's, the summary I've done of Genesis 1 through 11, and then as well as the setting of Abraham's life. And basically what I would say with that is that the setting of the Abrahamic covenant is the world after the flood in the Tower of Babel. And Genesis 1 through 11, God is in a sense dealing with, we might think of the nations, in other words, the whole world. And then when you get to Genesis 12, it shifts to focus on one person, and the one person is Abraham and then his descendants, because God makes that promise, for instance, in Genesis 3:15, that through the offspring of the woman, God will bring about his redemptive plans. But God's going to focus now in Genesis 12 on one person and his descendants, and that's Abraham. And then in Roman numeral 2, those four items there, where is the covenant found? And we've covered Genesis 12, 13, 15. Tonight, we'll look at 1 through 8, and that is the reiteration of the covenant. And then we'll look at verses 9 through 14, which deals with the sign of the covenant. Just like there was the sign with the Noahic, you remember that was the rainbow. Here we'll have another one as well. Now, what is a covenant? And we've kind of talked about, you could say a promise, if that makes it easier for you to remember. And in many ways, that is a good way to think of it, you know, is that it's a promise between two individuals. The only thing we really have to make sure we're clear on, though, is the Bible has the biblical covenants as conditional or unconditional. A conditional one would be, I will give you this if you do this. And so you have a part to play in it. If it's unconditional, it's completely, everything depends on God. The good thing about that one is, you know, it's going to be fulfilled. Okay. And I've already made a case many times. I'll reference a little bit tonight. The Abrahamic covenant, I think it's clear that that it's unconditional. So where is it found? What is a covenant? Conditional versus unconditional. And then the parties who benefit from the Abrahamic covenant is, again, Israel, Abraham, and the Gentiles. That's who is. So Abraham will be the beginning point, and through him, the nation of Israel, and then the nation of Israel, through Jesus, of course, for simplicity terms, will give benefits to the Gentiles and such. Now, in terms of the contents of the covenant are found in Genesis 12, 1 through 3. Now, there, it's important to remember before we look at the expansion of the covenant. Remember the Abrahamic covenant. First, God says, go. Doesn't tell him where, doesn't tell him how he's going to get there. He just says, go. And as he goes, I like to say he enters into the covenant with God. That's just my way of saying it. I still don't see it as a conditional based off of that, because he's not really asking him if he wants to go. He says, go. But as Abraham goes, he's entering into the covenant with God, if you want to think of it that way. God promises to Abraham a name, a nation, and land. And that's really the core contents of the covenant. Whenever we look at it, even in the expansion, if you just keep those in mind, the name of Abraham will be great, the nation will come through him, and then there's the promise of land. And that's the thing. And of course, the one phrase, and we'll see it again tonight, God says, I will. And usually, typically, whenever God says, I will, that implies it's unconditional, because God's saying, in effect, I'm going to do this despite or in spite of whatever you may or may not do. Now, has that been proven to be true? Yep, because Abraham doesn't even get out of what we call Genesis 12, and he's already trying to finagle things and manipulate things and scheme, maybe is a better word to use. And the way he schemes is God makes this promise to him, but then he thinks, well, famine and the Pharaoh, or excuse me, famine might stop God's promise. But anyway, then we looked at in chapters 13 and 15 what I call an expansion. That's what it's typically called. I think it's probably better said to be an expansion and or reiterated, because God's not always expanding it. He does, but he's also reiterating it. Typically, when you look at it in a theological book, it's going to say expansion. And I just think that's sometimes a little misleading, because God's not always expanding it. He's doing both. I think it's an and, or it's a both and. Now, he says when he expands that he promises to expand the descendants and the land. Do you remember the two S words that he uses as examples or illustrations, we might say? So that would be sand and stars, if you remember. He uses that. He uses that as sort of illustrative. Just as the sand you can't count, just as the stars you can't count, so thus will be, etc. And that's Genesis 13 and 15, those respective verses. So, all right, so that takes us up through, and again, it's not being a life study of Abraham, but that takes us up through chapter 15. I'm not going to cover, obviously, 16, because it doesn't really play any part in it. That is Sarai and Hagar. But I do want to draw your attention to something, which is verse 16 of chapter 16, and then we're going to get one of our lucky readers to read for me. But notice it says Abram was 86 years old. Okay, just note the age. When chapter 17, verse 1 comes around, he's 99. So just in brief, there's been about plus or minus 13 years. There's a period of silence. Sometimes people say, why doesn't God record everything? Because there's not enough space. Sometimes God moves the narratives along quick because there's not really anything, or for whatever reason. Sometimes you think of the descendants, it kind of moves the narrative along. But anyway, regardless, the main thing to remember here is there's been 13 years that have elapsed. And so when we look at this final contents, although Jacob will later on get reiterated some of this, but for Abraham, just remember that there's been 13 years that elapsed between the last verse in 16 and 17 when we look at this. And this will remind us that he's really old. Okay.
Raising a teenager.
Yeah. Yeah, so you remember, you think about it, he's going to be 99 years old and Isaac hasn't come yet. All right, so let's someone read We'll need two readers tonight, 1 through 8, and then after we look at that, we'll look through 9 through 14. So someone read 1 through 8 for me, and whoever wants to fight it out, and whoever loses gets to read.
Now when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be their God.
All right. Thank you, Gene. So this would be one of those, what's called expansion, but I call reiterating, if you will, or reconfirming. So 13 rough years have passed, somewhere around there approximately, since chapter 16 ended. So 13 years have passed. And so now Abraham appears, and he would be, of course, 99 years old. And he's old, right? I mean, there's no doubt about it. Even though they did live a long time, you know, in the New Testament says he was as good as dead almost there. But I mention that because the wording in here is important. If you notice, so when Gene was reading, it says he's 99. So obviously he's old. Okay, he's aged, very well aged. But notice, so the Lord appears to him after 13 years. We have no reference to any other appearance. We don't know what's happened during the 13 years. We assume nothing of any significance. But notice what God calls himself. He says, I am God Almighty. God has a lot of names in the Bible. You know, we sing those names sometimes. Sometimes we say them like Yahweh, but this one here, it is the where we get the idea of, if you ever heard the word El Shaddai, that's what this is, okay? And you might think, what's the big deal? Well, first off, almighty or all-powerful, any of those sort of synonyms you want to come across, God appears to him, he's 99, and God has not yet fulfilled the promise, which is to give the birth to, just for simplicity, Isaac. Isaac's birth is mentioned, if my memory is correct, is 21, chapter 21. The point is, God is using this name, and he calls himself that, as he says, I'm Almighty. Now, think of a couple of the reasons for this. God calls himself the Almighty. Is there anything that's too difficult for God? If God is all-powerful, then he can do this, right? So it makes sense that that would be his name. God, the all-powerful God, the idea of having Abraham become a father at that age is not a real big deal. It's just a big deal in our minds, you know. I read something not too long ago that basically says we like to play God so much that we begin to look at God thinking this is the way God acts, is the way we are. God isn't inhibited by anything, and since he's all-powerful, he can do anything. And I wonder, and of course there's no way to really know this, but you have to think, if you were Abram, do you think you might begin to think, okay, God, you know something's going to happen pretty soon. Do you ever wonder if maybe the circumstances are, maybe it's just impossible? Of course, nothing is impossible with God. I'm going to read you something. It's a little lengthy, but I just want you to understand why this is being used here, how it relates to the covenant, as well as a few other things. But I'll just read it. It's from a commentary on Genesis by Ken Fleming. I've referenced him a few times. It's a really good Genesis commentary, if you ever want to pick one up. It's Ken Fleming, he, and it's a few other ones. But anyway, he says, in this passage, God assures Abram of his power to bless him by giving him and Sarah, meaning Sarai, the long-promised son and heir. Like Abram, we too have El Shaddai as our God. What an encouragement it is to know that our God is strong and powerful. He fulfills his promises even when the circumstances seem impossible. So it's going to be from chapter 17 to chapter 21 before God ever fulfills the birth of Isaac. But it reminds, and it should remind Abraham, just like you and I, that, you know, the old expression, nothing is impossible for God, is it? So that's the idea. God is all powerful. Nothing can inhibit him from fulfilling what he says. So he appears to Abraham, just to go ahead and call him that. He calls himself, and God is calling himself this. So he gives himself this name. But then you see where I stick with, not that he's expanding the covenant so much here as he is reiterating or reconfirming it with Abraham. So after this lengthy period of time, God says, I'm powerful, I'm almighty, I can do anything. I'm going to fulfill my promises, and in case you forgot, here they are. And that's just my way of thinking it. So he says in here a couple of things. First is he reiterates or confirms, notice the things again, a name, nation, and land. So when you look through this, he says, I will establish my covenant. Whose covenant is it? We call it the Abrahamic covenant, but it's really God's covenant in the sense that God's the one who's making the covenant again. I still stick with unconditional. God says, I'm going to make my covenant. He says, I'll multiply you. Abraham doesn't speak. He falls on his face before God. And then, of course, God continues speaking and says in verse 4, you'll be the father of a multitude of nations. Now, when does God change Abraham's name? Well, it's in verse 5. So what does he do here with the name change? He goes from Abram to Abraham. So what he does is he goes from father who is exalted, or the exalted father, to what? What does Abraham mean? Does anybody know? It's father of a multitude. So what he's doing here is he says, your name is going from father, the exalted father, to the father of a multitude. So this is where he changes his name. So again, Abram to Abraham would be in effect saying, your name was from exalted father, now is going to be father of a multitude. And unrelated, but if you do have the question, if you look at verse 15, that's where Sarai's name becomes Sarah. If you just sort of an incidental, it's verse 15. So God reiterates it. He says, the name, the nation, and the land. Now, after all this time, is God still faithful to his word? One of the things I think is important for us, and this is just my way of expressing this. There's probably better ways to say it, but time does not erode the promises of God. I think that's really important for us to understand because, you know, God has promised many things in the Bible, and he's always fulfilled them. However, there are promises that he's given to, for instance, the church. He's given promises and so forth. And we know that we can trust God to fulfill them. I will tell you, if you think of some of those, or most of them are eschatological, if you think about it, you know, I think sometimes people sit there and think, you know, Jesus, he's promised to come back, right? It's been 2,000 years. Can we still believe God's promise? And the answer is yes. And I think that's important. But I just use the expression human time. In other words, time for us, it does not erode God's promises. We can't come in and say, well, it's been this long, so God, you're not going to do it, so I need to sort of fast forward you or whatever the case is. It doesn't work that way. So anyway, so he's reiterating, reconfirming the name, the nation, and the land. Probably not quite so much the name as he's just confirming the name here, and the name is changed. You could also see, I won't keep sort of beating this dead horse much more, but God says, I will. God is the one doing this. And so God, again, is the one, and again, he calls it my covenant. So the I wills is that God is the one doing everything, which implies that everything will get fulfilled. Now, let me ask you, and this is just the way to look at this. There is an aspect, though, where Abraham needs to live in a certain way. So the way I want you to look at these two descriptors in just a second is, how should Abraham live in view of these promises? I think this is an easier way to take it. There's a few ways you can address this, but there's two words, which is walk and blameless. And we're going to look at what those words mean. But I think an easy way to look at this is this. God appears after 13 years. He's already been a long time since he's made this original promise, and he's expanded the promise and reiterated it. He says, I'm all powerful. I can do anything and everything. Nothing is too hard for me to do, if you will. He reiterates everything. He changes his name. But how does he supposed to live this way? I mean, does he just do whatever he wants? Can he just live any way he wants to? Well, I think that that's a helpful way to think of it, is how is Abraham supposed to live? He's supposed to walk and be blameless. Okay, so what does that mean? I mean, he's been walking a long time. I mean, he left the Ur of Chaldees. Is that what he's talking about? The answer would be no. Okay, so first let's look at how he should live in light of these promises. You might could loosely equate it to, God's given you and I a lot of promises. How should we live today? Well, according to those types of things. Anyway, same idea. First is walk. Now, walk, he's not talking about footsteps. Okay? Walking is picturing an ongoing daily relationship with the Lord. Okay? So again, this is Stephen's description. So if you find a better one, go with that. And you probably could. But walking, and I'll show you how this fits in the New Testament, and you can see it, pictures an ongoing daily relationship with the Lord. Someone walked with God, and because they did, they were taken and they escaped death. You remember? It starts with an E, Enoch, walked with God. There's this descriptor in various parts of the Bible where an individual walks with God, and that's what that is. It's a close relationship with God. In the New Testament, the Apostle John uses this word in almost, I say, almost all of his writings. He uses the expression of walking, picturing discipleship. Now, let me ask you, are you supposed to, as a Christian, walk with God every day? Walk with the Lord? One of the best ones, I don't know if I've used this before, but it's probably just because it's one of my preferred ones, John 6, because everybody knows John 6, but just the first part. The first part is the feeding of the 5,000, right? One of the signs and miracles. And then Jesus walks on water. And then these people that got all these free things from him start asking him questions. And he says, well, you need to live a certain way. In other words, you need to live according to the teachings of that I'm giving you. And in John 6, 66, it says they quit walking with him. They quit following him because they didn't want to follow his commandments. Walking in the New Testament with John is discipleship. So that's the same thing. So what God in effect is telling Abram, having said that, is I am almighty, I am all powerful, I'm reminding you of the name, even though I've changed it as well, the nation and land, all those promises, I'm going to fulfill all of them. What I need you to do is first you need to walk with me. In other words, you need to continually have a relationship with me. But then he throws in that one's not too bad, but then he throws in the curveball, blameless. And we stumble over it because we think, okay, well, that's impossible because that means sinless perfection, and that's not what it means. The only, even air quotes, person who was perfect in this life was, of course, the Lord Jesus, and that's even a little bit misnomer because he's God in the flesh. But blameless in Hebrew, I'll tell you the two, I mean, if you do a word study, what you'll come away with is the word basically means whole, complete, with integrity. So to be blameless would be comparable to, if you use the Hebrew word, whole, completely, and with integrity. Okay? So what he's telling him is you need to walk not just a little bit with me, not just partially, but how? Wholly, completely. This isn't sinlessness, because that would be impossible. God would be setting a standard that, well, I don't know, maybe you could do it, but I couldn't. I couldn't walk sinlessly before we got here, before Sunday, probably. I have a thought, word, and deed, probably, So the idea here is to walk wholly and completely with the Lord, and it should be done with integrity. Now, it would imply as well to follow God's commandments. And that answers the question of what happens if he falls into sin? What happens if you and I fall into sin? 1 John 1, 9, right? What are we supposed to do? We are to obey God and do what he says. And we confess our sins, God cleanses us. So when we walk with God, when we have mistakes along the way, we continuously, of course, have to confess sin. I think the sin part is the part we struggle with because we're thinking, okay, I've got to be perfect. And that's not what it's talking about. So if you went back and reread it using that sort of language, God is saying, I am El Shaddai. I am going to reconfirm my covenant with you. I want you to walk with me completely, not partially, in fullness, not sinlessness, but walk in integrity. And when you make a mistake or whatever you're doing, you need to walk in accordance with the scripture, because then when I find you, as long as you're walking with the ways that I told you to, I have no charge in a sense against you. So that's just sort of my way of saying it. Now, Thomas Constable puts it this way, and it's a lot less wordy than what I just said, but he says, God requires such a life, meaning blameless and walking with God. He says, God requires such a life of those who would enjoy his promised blessings. Does that make sense? The idea is, do you think God, I hate to use this as an example, do you think God's going to bless our church if we're in sin and blatant disregard for him? No, of course not, right? Now, however, we make a mistake, we confess it, God's going to look down and say, they are following what I'm saying. That's different. So we can't expect God to bless us if we're just going to live any way we want to. I kind of think of it as, you know, Paul says, shall I sin so that grace abounds? God forbid. Yep. And it's just sort of the idea there, just to kind of reconcile that. So it means to wholly, completely walk with God, not sinlessness, but walk with integrity, follow my commandments, and as long as we are endeavoring to do that, God is not an ornery God looking to get us. But I can guarantee you this, if we are blatantly in open rebellion against God and his word, and we're just like, I'm not going to do what he says, God's not going to bless. That's just craziness. Okay? All right. So we've covered the contents. That's basically the contents. We've covered Genesis 12, 13, 15, 17, 1 through 8. But let's finish up with verses 9 through 14. This one's a little bit more straightforward. I would tell you, if you're interested, you don't necessarily have to. If you want to read the full expanse of this encounter, it's chapter 17, verse 1, and it goes through verse 22. And you can see it. It's sort of like a bookend. Verse 1 says that Abraham, God appeared before Abraham. There's all this dialogue. And then in verse 22, God leaves. So that's the pericope, in other words, if you want to read it. But for our purposes, we're going to see if I can get an adventurous reader, because just like the Noahic covenant has a sign, so does the Abrahamic. So let's just read 9 through 14, because that will suffice for what we need.
God said further to Abraham, now as person shall be cut off from his people, he has broken my covenant.
All right. So thank you very much. So 9 through 14, that would be the sign. So that's the last of the Roman numerals there, the last piece, which is the sign of the covenant. And there's several reasons for it, meaning why you would have and even do it. Let me mention first is the obvious one. It's the same as with the Noahic. When you look at the Noahic covenant sign, which is a rainbow, when we see a rainbow, what should we think of? Beyond Noah's Ark. Yeah, no, I'm just kidding. But Noah's Ark, but the promise that God wouldn't flood the earth again, and all those promises that he's made. So in all seriousness, correct. We would think of the ark. We would think of the promise that was given that God wouldn't flood the earth. And then you have the Noahic there. So it reminds of the promise of God. And so it's a sign, if you will, and the sign has a meaning behind it. If you struggle with that concept, because John uses signs as miracles, in other words, a term for that, are you afraid of a stop sign? Not really. What you're afraid of is what's behind it, which is representative of the police, right? So in this case, the sign of the circumcision points to remembering the promises of God. So after all these years, they could go back and say, you know what? God has promised through Abraham to bless the nations and so on and so forth. We don't need to give up. We don't need to worry that God won't fulfill them. So it's a reminder. Now, circumcision itself, does anyone know what the term actually means? I'm not trying to trick you or anything, but it means to cut. Dave and I both squeam, and the men squeam here, but it means literally to cut. And the cutting was to be done on the eighth day. What day was Jesus circumcised on?
Eighth day.
Luke 2:21. Now, if you just think about that, from this period in Genesis 17 all the way to Luke 2:21, God's promise would be remembered and all that. So it's kind of interesting. I'm going to read you some. This is an excerpt from a medical journal. It's actually in a commentary, but they were referencing it. It's kind of interesting. You know how science sometimes proves God's promises? Okay. Now, look, I went to Bible college and seminary. I am not a health and human, like, doctor services person, so maybe this has changed, but it is kind of interesting. It says, a medical journal says, today, vitamin K is routinely administered to newborns shortly after their delivery, and this eliminates a clotting problem and so forth. But notice it says, however, before the days of vitamin K injections, a 1953 pediatrics textbook recommended that the best day to circumcise a newborn was, guess what? The eighth day. It's just interesting how science, or whatever you want to call it, health, eventually catches up with what God's already told us to begin with. So just as the rainbow reminds us of the promises given related to the Noahic covenant, so does the circumcision remind us of the promises that God gave to Abraham. I was trying to think of what in the world to think of when we finish a study, because, I mean, I've covered everything, and I'll give some time for questions in a minute. But I think probably the most important thing is to remember God's promises can be trusted, but we have to also remember He fulfills them in His own time, in His own way. You can't hurry God along, and you can't slow Him down either. I'm going to end with this. It's an interesting quote. It's by this man named Anonymous. I'm telling you, he has so many quotes. We need to do like an Anonymous quote book. But it talks about the promise of God, and I think he's right on, whoever this he or she is. Probably a she, it's because it's so well written. God is the God of promise. He keeps His word, even when that seems impossible, even when the circumstances seem to the point to be the opposite. And that's true, isn't it? God can always be trusted. All right, comments, questions, that covers everything that we had on the study handout. Does anybody have any questions other than circumcision?